but I'd been impressed by the place. The innkeeper was a large, friendly woman named Mother Breeder, who treated everyone who crossed her threshold like family. That isn't always a good thing. Her four grown sons helped her run the place, whether it was cooking, slaughtering a goat, bringing up beer from the cellar, splitting firewood, doing laundry, or changing the straw in the mattresses. The four boys, I use the term figuratively, the eldest was over 30 and the youngest was 17, scrambled around hectically while their mother sat on the stool by the fire that was her unofficial throne and yelled orders. I don't mean that she casually shouted, like Mama would occasionally do. I mean this woman screamed her desires at the top of her lungs. From anywhere within a half-mile radius of the lakeside inn, you could hear her bellow. When I say she treated everyone like family, that meant that she felt free to shout at you, as if you were one of her boys. If you were actually in the same room with her, it was deafening. Concerned that she was going a little deaf herself, I'd casually checked her hearing and such a few months back and found her in perfect health. I guess she just liked to shout. We were among only a few guests that day. There were a small number of peasants from Winnaker in town on business, stopping in for a pint of ale before they made the long walk back home, and there was a single pack trader who lingered over a bowl of stew. But that was it. I ordered from Mama Breeder, who bellowed the order back to her youngest son, and then joined Tyndall at one of the trestle tables. Tyndall was hacking into an excellent hunk of bright yellow Beauval cheese, and a half of a loaf of her bread. Not as good as Dad's, but whose is? And was waiting for a bowl of the stew that was bubbling over the fire and filling the air with such gastronomical promise. He had thoughtfully ordered a tall mug of ale for me already, which I used to wash the road dust from my mouth while I was waiting for my own lunch. "How did Master Garkescu take the news, Master?" he asked between wolfish bites. "With his customary grace," I said, making a sour face. He tried to convince me to give him the stone. I tried to convince him that he needs to prepare for a war.
"Do you think it will be war, then? The goblins, Gavanni, have always been peaceful. Since we took the valley away from them, that is."
He looked worried and scared and excited all at the same time. "Yes, well, apparently at least a few of them want it back. Did they look particularly peaceful last night?"
"Not really,"
my apprentice admitted between bites. If this band wasn't alone, then this could be just the opening move in a larger conflict, I warned him, depressed at the prospect.
"Then we'll be ready for them."
Tyndall tried to sound savage and brave, and might have if his voice had not chosen that moment to break an octave. I grinned and then fell to eating when the stew appeared. It was three meat, three bean stew cooked for days with wine and vegetables. Wholesome and hearty, and with the cheese, it was exquisite.
"Do you really think the tree folk will be able to help us, Master?"
Tyndall asked me again, after his mouth cleared. "Honestly, Tyndall," I confessed between bites, "I'm mostly going to the Alcalon to see what they know about Irionite. Thanks to the censorate, it has been so scarce in the duchies that it's considered legendary. The piece I'm wearing around my neck is enough to buy yourself a decent-sized barony, if you were to sell it to one of the rich old imperial families, and not attract the ire of the censorate." His eyes lit up. Nothing inspires a poor peasant lad like the idea of wealth.
"You should sell it, then,"
he exclaimed enthusiastically. I laughed and shook my head. "No, I'm going to hang on to it. It is very dangerous, and I just don't know enough about its properties and abilities. No living man does. The last one who did was the mad mage of Faris, and he's dead. Before that, he was mad, and likely not terribly helpful."
"But the tree folk, no?"
he asked, intrigued that the childhood legends of the little people he'd heard might not only exist, but be talented at his new profession. "The tree folk use it frequently, it is said. Their spellcraft, it's far more subtle and elegant than ours. No human mage has ever successfully found proficiency at it, let alone mastered it, though many have tried. I'm hoping that perhaps, if we ask nicely enough, they will consent to teach us how to use the stone. It would be invaluable in our defense against future raids, not to mention educational in its own right. I didn't mention powerful enough to rouse the military strength of 3 duchies against it, but I didn't want to complicate the boys' thoughts with political reality.
I wonder what got them all stirred up like that. The goblins, I mean. My ma used to see them up in the high meadows sometimes. Said she would trade meat and leather and eggs for iron tools and sometimes even gems. They make good ironwork, she said, but they never gave us any trouble.
I don't know, I admitted. The Gavani I met on the road to Faris were warriors, but they kept to their own territories up in the mountains and rarely bothered the human tribes. Not until the Doge's troops started trying to conquer their mountain passes. I can't imagine what would drive them to this.
Something pretty powerful, I expect.
Or it could be as little as a single shaman with a witch stone, trying to prove his worthiness to impress a girl goblin. I fondled the stone in its pouch. I guess he failed. That got me thinking, a bad habit of mine when I'm eating. Tyndall knew enough to leave me alone when I lapsed into silence like that. After a while, I turned back to him with a question. How did this valley come to be settled here anyway? What's the history?
Well, I don't know much. Mostly what Mao and her friends told me, but almost 200 years ago, Sire Kusi's great-great-great-grandsire was given this land for his assistance in the last of the Goblin Wars. The last battle was fought here, near Bovol Castle, actually. Sire Kusi's ancestors did something brave in battle, and the Duke of Ulshar himself granted his family the lands of the Vale as a reward, and also gifted him with a harp of gold, 20 cows, among the finest of his herds, and 2 strong bulls named Hold, I said, putting up my hand.
Did you say the last of the Goblin Wars?
I believe I did, Master.
Then I think I may have discovered the reason we were attacked. I knew the Govani tribes fought against the Ulshari when pushed beyond the frontier established by the Majocracy to settle. I didn't know the last battle was here. But it makes sense. The Ulshari Wilderlands were the last to be settled, and then only sparsely. We humans, were never supposed to go this far into the territory, according to Imperial history. He shrugged.
Does it make a difference, Master? The Majocracy has been gone for centuries now.
It might. I know the Imperials in the East still hold a grudge over the old Imperial Palace, the site of their last battle. That's why the Eastern Dukes built new ones when they took over, and gave the old Imperial Palace at Rhenes to the priests of Goma. Where did your ancestors come from, Tyndall? Before Bovol?
Well, on my mother's side, we came with Lord Kusi's company. He gave us the Heights in return.
The Heights was the name of the farm that Tyndall's drunken mother owned. She barely held it now, and she and Tyndall rarely spoke. He often mentioned how nasty she could be. One reason he sought employment elsewhere when he was old enough to leave the farm. Of his father, he spoke even less. Apparently, he and his mother had been a very brief acquaintance. Ever see any of the Gavani artifacts around? You don't just put those up because you like to decorate.
Well, there are the forest stones, these carved rocks you can find in the woods. But Mar says the tree folk put them there, not the goblins. There are plenty of caves, though. We used to play in them. The small ones near the pastures during the summer. I even saw a few goblins once, hunting. They even waved. There might be a few things of theirs left in them. Ma would never let me go to the ones higher up.
Very wise of her, I said. I couldn't help teasing him a little. While the Gavani don't eat human flesh as a rule, it has been known to happen, and children are, I imagine, pretty tasty.
Good to know,
Tyndall replied, wide-eyed. After that, the conversation turned to the usual daily bull session on magic, where Tyndall asked me questions, and I tried to answer them without getting frustrated. I was starting to realize that teaching was a lot harder than I'd expected. When we had sopped up the very last shred of stew and drained our mugs, I paid the shot and had the horses brought around. We got back on the road. I wanted to make as much time as possible before sundown. The Govani are nocturnal. We made good time, too. The roads in Bovol, where well-travelled, are not bad for a rustic domain. The weather was pleasant, just a slight chill that presaged the coming winter, and the bright autumn sunshine warmed our faces as we rode. I continued the lesson on war wands from the saddle, as well as I was able, and I was impressed at how quickly Tyndall was picking up the theory. Recent events had spurred his interest in the subject, of course, and he wanted to know everything at once. We were about 2 hours north of Himmers on the North Road, when we heard screams in the distance, followed by a particular snarl that I'd heard all too recently. I glanced at the sun sourly. They are supposed to be nocturnal. Another scream, another snarl. Someone was in trouble, and I was the closest thing to a hero within shouting distance. Tyndall was startled too, his eyes wide at the sound. He was immobilized by the scream.
Shit! Tyndall, arm your wand and follow me! Don't worry about attacking, just keep them off my back, I said,
as I stood in the stirrups and summoned my defenses. My rouncy steed, Traveller, lurched forward eagerly. I didn't bother looking back to see if my apprentice was following, partly because of the potential embarrassment I would have felt if he hadn't, and partly because I was trying to foresee the situation ahead of us. Trying to sling spells from the saddle is a very refined art, a specialty of some equestrian war magi who can get it right most of the time. I'm as good a horseman as a baker's son has any right to be, and had ridden extensively during my professional career, but I still had difficulty concentrating enough to complete the simple reconnaissance spell properly. The fuzzy result gave me only vague awareness of the situation ahead. It was, of course, more goblins. I could foresee a knot of them clustered around one or two humans. That was adequate enough intelligence to determine my plan of action, but far from ideal. I put spur to flank and drew slasher with one hand, a war wand with the other, and bravely rode into the unknown. In moments I entered the scene of destruction, no doubt cutting a dashing and heroic figure, if anyone had been there to observe carefully. There was a whole band of them, almost a score, or at least there had been. Two lay still and bleeding, and two more clutched their heads and screamed piteously in the overbright sunshine. But the others were surrounding the humans and poking at them playfully with spears and clubs, and laughing at their torment. I was coming upon their band from the rear. They had just started to turn to the sound of travellers' hoofbeats when I was upon them. Slasher swept the heads off of two as I battled around the bend. Traveller's hooves trampled a third. He's not a warhorse, but he's quite intelligent, and he knew what to do when I commanded him like this. The momentum of our charge was enough to bowl over a handful of them in a tangled heap. My wand played across a pile of Gavani as I leapt, or fell, depending on how you looked at it, from the saddle. I was gratified that it chewed holes in their bodies enough to get their attention. The goblins had been taken by surprise, but that didn't stop those of them who hadn't fell in my attack from regrouping. Suddenly I was faced with a small and angry mob of hostile little furry buggers. While I was not thrilled with the prospect, they had turned their attention from their victims to face me, and I hoped that helped. Before my boots had skidded to a halt, Slasher was parrying their nasty little clubs and spears while I lined up more targets for my wand in my mind. I didn't have much in the way of combat spells prepared and hung after the busy night I'd had, so I just fought like hell. A couple of times I even used my wand as a club. The goblins pressed me aggressively, threatening me from almost every side, but their smaller stature and the potential for hitting allies in the battle made them cautious. I had no such handicap. I poked my sword wherever I felt it would do the most good, slicing arms and legs and eyes indiscriminately. One by one they fell back, some of them permanently. I used one of the last of my offensive spells to blast a knot of three of them to shreds, and discourage a few more behind them. Traveller, too, was having a grand old time rearing and stomping. He hadn't seen action in almost a year, and I saw at least one crumble from a bolt from Tyndall's new wand. Their number had suddenly dwindled to five increasingly panicky little warriors who were visibly considering fleeing from my attack, when they were hit from the rear by one of their intended victims. A young farm woman was wielding a stout cowherd staff with anger and precision about their furry ears. The Gravani squealed in frustration as she brained the first, no doubt disheartened by being attacked from the rear twice in one day. A sweep of the staff and she knocked another off of his feet, where Tyndall ended his attack and his life with a clumsy dagger blow to the chest. The added distraction of the farm girl's attack made cleaning up the others a lot easier, with Slasher and Traveller, and within moments all of the Gervani raiders had been dispatched or fled. I heaved for breath while my nerves tried to recover from the excitement. It was easier to do this kind of thing when I was augmented, and I made a mental note to rehang the spell tonight. I was covered from head to toe in hot blood and black hair. I regarded the woman over the heap of bodies. Indeed, I recognized her. She was young, perhaps 20, and her hair was plaited in 2 long braids over each ear. Her dress was the stout brown plaid wool that was favored in Beauvall, and it, too, was stained with blood. But so was the end of her staff. Her labored breathing made her breasts swell appreciatively, and I was suddenly reminded of one of my natural reactions to combat. She was quite an attractive woman, I saw. Handsome, rather than pretty, and she held that staff like she meant it. I was intrigued. As I said, I recognized her, but in my 6 months in the Vale, I had met a lot of people, even a lot of pretty young women. That didn't produce her name in my mind, unfortunately.
"You? Can you help me with him?"
she said, glancing at her companion, who lay in the dirt next to the road, clutching his shoulder and moaning. She didn't drop the staff.
Yes, of course,
I said, confused by her casual reaction to violence. Most women would be squealing and screaming at the carnage and how close they came to death. Hell, I guess I expected her to swoon and shower me with kisses, but she was acting as calmly as if she were selling cheese in the market. I stabbed Slasher into the ground nearby while I knelt by the fallen. Tyndall came up beside me, eyes wide and darting as he looked for more foes, his short bow now strung and his war wand in hand.
"That was all of them,"
I said, not as sure as I sounded about the fact.
"But keep an eye out for stragglers, while I tend him. This man needs help. Bring my bag from the horse, but keep your eyes sharp."
He nodded and turned, but that wand never left his white-knuckled fist. He threw a casual wave to the woman, whom he apparently knew, and trotted off. The injured man was a little older than the woman, maybe 28, and he had several wounds to boast about. He also had a bloodied harrowing knife in his hand. He stared at me with unreal eyes, and I could tell that there was a problem. The woman knelt beside me and cradled his head in her arms.
"He's going into shock. Tyndall, your cloak. Is he your husband?"
She shook her head.
"My brother-in-law, Sargal. We were headed to Himmus for tomorrow's market, and they came out of nowhere. How bad is he?"
"I'm not a healer," I warned.
"I know who you are," she said, her pretty eyes flashing. "And it's not a healer. I bet you can do something. Or are all you good for is tracking down wandering cows?"
She was right. I'm not a healer, but I had learned plenty of combat aid in the army, and every spellmonger does a little healing on animals or people, depending on his situation.
"You know, I'm quite good with wandering cows,"
I said, blushing indignantly. I summoned mage sight and pushed my awareness into the muscles and bones of his shoulder. It was a holy mess. The scapula was cracked, and the humerus was crushed, but not beyond repair, and certainly not life-threatening. A stab wound in his gut was more worrying. It wasn't bleeding badly, but it was dangerously close to the intestines. A punctured gut could lead to peritonitis, which would kill him in a few painful days if he wasn't tended to. But that would be in a few days. He needed to be stabilized long before that. Tyndall brought his cloak and covered the man as I opened the leather satchel that I had carried to Faris and back. My supply of bandages was low, but there was enough there to cover the gut wound. I opened a vial of Memphor's liquor and poured it onto the bandage before I pushed it into the wound. The man moaned, and his eyelids began to flutter. I took half a dried charo root and crushed it between my palms before sticking it in his mouth and holding my water skin to his lips. It would need a little time to work, but it would likely keep him out of shock if we could get him off the road.
"What's his name again?"
I asked the woman while I began to fashion a litter out of Tyndall's cloak. I used my staff for one side, and hers for the other.
"Sargal. He's married to my sister, Ella. Their farm is about half a mile back up the road. She's going to go insane when she sees him. just to warn you. What's your name again? I just remember that you're the new spellmonger.
She didn't seem impressed, so I tried to impress her. Master Minolan of Castal, among other places, at your service. I granted, warranted by the Duke to practice general spellcraft and thaumaturgy.
That's right. I remember you. You set the fire wards at Goodman Jarl's place last month. I saw you there that day. My holding is just behind his, up the ridge and north.
So, now you know me, what about yourself? Do you have a name? Tyndall and I took the ailing farmer and placed him as gently as we could in the stretcher. He moaned in pain at the movement, but he seemed to be a little more comfortable.
Of course. Alia, daughter of Roral, of Hawk's Reach. That's our farm.
I've heard of it. Your dad, too. Well, Alia of Hawk's Reach, I hope you're fond of your brother-in-law. Goddess willing, he will survive. If you are not fond of him, there is still time to poison him before he gets home. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. She grinned and showed a fetching set of dimples that paled in comparison to her smile.
No, I really am fond of him. He was friends with my late husband.
A lass as young as you, a widow? I asked, surprised. I shouldn't have been. A lot of things can kill you in the Wilderlands.
Yes,
she said, her smile fading.
He died in a riding accident 1.5 years ago. I gave our farm back to his parents and moved home. I help my father run the creamery now.
I'm sorry, I said, and I meant it. Damn it, I wanted that smile back.
Thank you. Now, can you answer me this? Where the bloody hell did all these damned goblins come from?
Her voice broke at the memory of the fight she was just in.
We were headed out to Hemis to see about some shears and some tonic. Sargal's got a sick calf when they sprang out from the trees. At first I thought they were begging. That happens sometimes,
she explained, and I've traded with the mountain folk food for firewood often enough.
But then out came the clubs and suddenly we were fighting for our lives. I'm so glad you showed up when you did,
she said gratefully.
Finally.
When one does go out of one's way to rescue a damsel in distress, an outpouring of heartfelt thanks and gratitude is to be expected on the part of said damsel. Perhaps some light kissing and hugging. Occasionally the offer of a reward, either monetary or sexual, is added, and usually refused by the noble. But the regulations governing such things are pretty straightforward on the gushes of gratitude, from what I recall of the legends and sagas.
It was no trouble. My apprentice and I were just passing. Yeah, it would have taken me most of an hour to finish them all off myself,
she said, without a trace of doubt.
Sargal might not have made it by then.
I stared at her just a moment too long, and inspired a blush that showed off every freckle on her face. Well, since they were obviously interrupting your busy schedule, I'm just happy I could help out.
They are just Gervani, she said dismissively. I don't know about this lot, but most of them would scatter at a loud noise.
My face turned serious. It's not just this band. 100 or more of them attacked Minden's Hall 2 nights ago. Almost 40 people died. Buildings burned. It took Sire Kusi and his cavalry to drive them away.
That's terrible. We hadn't heard yet, she confessed.
She glanced back at the bodies of the fallen goblins, some still twitching, while I finished my improvised stretcher.
Not many beggars in that lot either. Lots of clubs, a few spears, lots of snarling fangs and bloody claws. They did mean to harm us. I just never expected they would do that.
My lady, I've seen the Gervani fight deep in the jungles of Faris, and I assure you that they are a most capable foe when properly roused. From what Sire Kusi tells me, I said, on the theory that dropping the name of the local lord might possibly impress her, they haven't been a problem here since the Goblin Wars.
That's right, she agreed thoughtfully. They've always been very respectful to us. Can we move him back to his hold? It's not far.
This litter is ready to go. Tyndall, help me get Goodman Sargal home to his wife.
Goody Alia,
I have no idea what has troubled them so. But now they are troubling me and other good folk, and that is something for which I cannot stand. I tried to sound brave and resolute, and only realized after I said it that it sounded pompous and self-important. Luckily, I still had some points left from saving her life, and she overlooked it. Tyndall pulled the litter behind his horse while I let Alia lead Traveller, and I cleaned my sword. We walked slowly and warily, but that also allowed me a chance to speak with her at length about all sorts of completely unimportant but vital things. The walk lasted 20 minutes, and by the time we approached the front gateway to her sister's house, I was genuinely smitten with the pretty young widow. Quite odd for a first date, I know. But, in fairness, I've been on worse. Things don't always turn out the way we planned them, as anyone familiar with the gods should know. Trig knows my life didn't.
"Dad, what can I do?"
I whined when I was 13, seeing my world crumbling around me. I didn't want to be a mage. I wanted to be a baker, like him. "Do?" he asked, eyebrows raised. "Well, the first thing we'll do is go up to the castle to be seen by the mage," he said, scratching his beard. "It's possible that you have an erratic or weak talent," he admitted. "This morning's fire could be a unique occurrence, in which case nothing much will change. But the responsible thing to do is to get Master Tilo to test you. Or perhaps you are favored of Brigga, the fire goddess and patroness of bakers." While he was a little unsure about the differences between a spell and a miracle, a devotion to the flame that burneth bright might lead me to take religious orders in her name, which would have pleased him immensely, I knew. "On the other hand, you could possess enough talent to warrant further training as an apprentice mage. There's plenty of good work for a spellmonger or a hedge mage, if they know their craft, and the post of court wizard is a notoriously cushy and lucrative one. Though it's not as stable or as honourable tradition as baking," he said. When I knew he wasn't mad at me, I felt immensely better, and only partially because of the liquor that warmed me from the inside out. "I suppose we should go ahead and start. Wait here. I'll get Goron to run the shop this morning." Goron was my oldest sister's husband, and second in line for inheriting the shop and the charter after me. He'd married my eldest sister the year before, after apprenticing with Dad for 2 years. I liked Goron, more than I liked my sister. Goron, I knew, would be pleased at the idea of me leaving the baker's trade. He didn't relish the idea of eventually working for a lad half his age. I nodded and grabbed the jar for another sip while he was gone. It took us most of the morning to walk up to the castle. It was a strange and happy time for me. Walking along the slightly muddy road next to the river at sunrise, my dad joking and laughing with me, nervous but at ease at the same time. The liquor had warmed me, and Dad had had the foresight to grab a few sweet rolls for breakfast on his way out. He made me feel a lot better about the whole thing just by being there. By the time we reached the gates of the castle, I knew that I was still his son, and he would always love me, even if I was suddenly special. It took us another half hour to get in to see the Vice Castellan, a snooty Remeran who obviously thought that we needed getting rid of. Dad wasn't about to be brushed off like some dirt farmer, though. He was an artisan of note. He stood his ground, and I was surprised at just how quickly we found ourselves in front of the Baron and Baroness, who were just starting breakfast when we were ushered in by the Vice Castellan. At the time, I thought it was because Dad was such an important person in the village. The Baron treated him with respect. Though in retrospect, the hot, freshly baked sugar rolls which Dad presented to Baron Lethar may have had some influence. You could smell those things across the room. His Excellency listened with great interest to my father's story. Then he asked us to sit with him and the Baroness while we waited for Master Tilo to arrive from his tower at the other end of the great castle. I was in awe and didn't make a sound. We were breaking our fast with nobility. Master Tilo showed up in good time, just as the Baron was finishing telling us of his son's recent tournament victory. The old mage was resplendent in his decorated robe and richly embroidered woolen mantle. He arrived in the hall blowing hot breath through his hands. The castle seemed far colder than home, I noticed, and remember feeling sorry for the Baron that he had to live in such a drafty place, and he was just as delighted by the sugar rolls as the Baron and Baroness. He, too, heard my story, and after grabbing the last sugar roll off the table, he agreed to test me. I remember those tests pretty well. He led me back to his tower, through the maze of the castle, and into his mysterious workshop. Master Tilo was thorough at his craft, and wasn't satisfied with the first, or even the 21st, arcane test. He placed stones on the back of my hand and had me tell him about my earliest memories. He had me hold a stick in both hands and spin around clockwise, then counterclockwise. He put a bag over my head and asked me about my favorite colors. He wrapped me in red thread and had me sing. I felt like an idiot. When my stomach reminded me that it was closer to noon than dawn, Tilo finally sat down, lit his pipe, and bid me absent-mindedly to sit.
"Well, my boy, it looks like you do have a lick of talent after all," he admitted kindly.
I swallowed hard. "I do, Master?" He nodded, his grey head wreathed in smoke.
"Yes, more than we can safely ignore. In fact, in terms of raw talent, I believe you have more than both my apprentices put together."
My chest swelled with pride even as my heart sank.
"So I'm to be a mage, then?"
"Just like that," he laughed. "That remains to be seen. Any idiot can be born with a talent, Menelin. Talent is just the beginning of magic. If you have not the intelligence, the discipline, the focus to master the talent will master you. And wisdom. Always wisdom. The most powerful mage in the world falters if his wisdom fails him. I think you might have the wits to learn, but I detect a tinge of foolishness in you that could prove deadly in a mage," he added warningly.
"I am but 13, Master," I said somberly, fibbing my age up a bit. "I would be 13, come autumn at least. I am prone to foolishness."
He laughed, sending thick clouds of smoke billowing out of his nose.
"So you are. Can you read?"
"Only a bit, Master. Not well. But I know my letters," I said proudly.
We will need to fix that, and soon. Menelin, we have established you have talent. Let us see what we can make of it."
For the next 3 days I went to the castle at dawn and did not return home until long after dark. My days were spent in lessons on the very basics of recognizing my talent and learning how to feel its utility and power, and learning how to really read. Sometimes it was just Master Tilo and I, and sometimes his apprentices helped. The court mage asked me thousands of seemingly simple questions and wrote the answers on a long piece of parchment. I was worried at first that I might get them wrong, but he threw them at me so fast that I didn't have time to worry about one before the next one arrived. We would take a break every hour or so, then back to the testing and the lessons. I had no idea what the tests were about, but later I realized that my talent was impressive enough so that Master Tilo was considering sending me elsewhere, where it could be more properly developed. In the meantime, everyone at home was in a tizzy about my display of talent. Mama was not happy, of course. I was her baby. But my eldest sister was about to make her a grandmother, and that deadened the pain a bit. My sisters were, in general, loath to see me develop the talent, Ura especially. Only 2 years older than me, most of my chores would fall to her until she found a man stupid enough to marry her. My sisters all began to dote on me even more than usual, as if I were sick and would never get well. All but Ura. When Dad told the story about how I started a fire because I was so upset with her, she began keeping her distance from me. Mama tried to act like nothing was wrong, and Dad put on his most patient expression when I was around after that. He spent a lot of time in his workroom. On the fourth day, Master Tilo visited the bakery before I could come to the castle. He and my parents sat me down at the kitchen table, where Mama had set a healthy-sized snack and our best glassware, and he unrolled that long piece of parchment. "The results were finished," he announced with a stone face. I was not only extremely talented, but Master Tilo had determined that I had more brains than the average peasant. I could very easily become a spellmonger, perhaps even more. I was proud, and felt quite the man.
Minolan, I was lucky enough to be trained at the Inarian Imperial Academy of Magic, Master Tilo finally said. I didn't serve a normal apprenticeship, like most magi. I was taught in the classical manner, just like the magi of the magocracy. While I could take you to apprentice here in Talri, I already have two apprentices. Taking another would be unfair to all of you. My heart fell. Now, I could likely arrange for an apprenticeship with one of my colleagues in Kuri, or even in Dretzel, but I really believe that you would benefit the most from a more classical education. You have that much potential.
Oh, yes, Master,
I said, my mind spinning out of control. I had a copy of your test results made and sent to Inarian yesterday, with a letter introducing you to the rector. It will be weeks before we hear back, but you may actually have a chance to attend. That is a chance few common-born magi ever have. I hope you understand. A certificate from Inarian will guarantee you a position in a court somewhere.
Leave Tari? Leave Mama and Dad?
I squeaked. Suddenly, I didn't feel so manly anymore. Master Tilo nodded sagely.
It will be a great adventure, lad. Long and hard study, and twice as hard as you are not of noble birth. And it will be lonely. But the rewards are worth it, my boy. Pursuing the art arcane and learning from such masters is well worth the price.
But the choice is up to you,
Mama blurted out.
There's no guarantee you will even be accepted, son, Dad said.
I knew in his heart he didn't want me to be. They were both trying to be brave and think about my future, not their dashed dreams of a baking dynasty.
Can I think about it?
I said in a small voice.
Certainly, Master Tilo said with a kindly laugh. We have time. But think well and hard on it, and use what little wisdom you have to aid you.
A week before, I would have run away and hidden in the ash heap until he was gone. It had been a busy week, though, and I was no longer the boy I was when I stacked that firewood on that fateful morning. I felt the enormous pressure of abandoning the only life I knew, all of my dad's plans for leaving me his bakery, for the chance at something almost completely unknown to me. I solemnly agreed to think about it, and then went outside to play. In the days that followed, I noticed that the change in attitude went beyond my family, as my mates were starting to treat me differently. Mooli, one of my best friends, would hardly even talk to me, and Tico was scared I would turn him into something unnatural if I got angry. While I kind of resented their distance, I also reveled in the importance my nascent talent had granted me. I actually used it to win them back as friends again, by showing them the two or three of the simple cantrips Master Tilo had shown me already. The ability to light a candle with my finger, for instance, made me powerful among the boys of Talri. Soon they were all vying for a position as my best friend, and if I took unreasonable advantage of the situation, I can only plead immaturity as my excuse. One area that did not suffer because of my talent was my relation with the girls of the village. I had started noticing them a year back, but had not impressed them overmuch with my strength, speed, or prowess at games and races, and therefore hadn't garnered much attention. Now they showed significant interest. A spellmonger's wife was at least as high an aspiration as a baker's wife, and the thought of being the wife of a court mage, with all of its supposed luxury, was hard to resist to the village girls thinking about their futures. A few became ardent admirers, though they shyly kept their distance from me. But one girl, Hedy, the miller's daughter, was so intrigued by my magical reputation that she was willing to overcome her typical village girl shyness. She was 2 years my senior, and while not the prettiest girl between river and hill, she was handsomely built and had pretty eyes and soft brown hair that smelled really good. She was a curvaceous 14-year-old vixen I'd always had a crush on, and she finally took enough interest in me to relieve me of my virginity behind her father's warehouse. I was, if you'll excuse the expression, enchanted by girls after that. By the end of the summer, I had convinced 4 other village girls and 2 farm girls to steal my innocence from me in various ways, and I began to see that there were definitely some benefits to the trade of magic. Master Tilo continued our daily lessons, which included teaching me to read and figure, as well as schooling me in some of the more basic magical exercises every mage needs to know. But for one solid summer, I was the boy every other boy wanted to be friends with, and the boy every girl wanted to pick flowers for. As the leaves began to turn color at the end of that glorious summer, a message arrived from downriver. I had, indeed, been accepted to the academy. I was to report, 6 weeks hence, to the Master of Novices in Inarian Academy for introductory training. I was shocked. I never expected to get in. After all, I was a peasant, or at least a commoner, and the Inarian Academy was built for the magically inclined nobility. Old imperial nobility at that, or at least wealthy coast lords, sea lords, or river lords. Ignorant Narasi commoners became hedge magi or village spellmongers. They just didn't go to one of the finest schools in the Five Duchies to learn the arcane arts. At the time, I figured that I was just so especially talented that they couldn't ignore me. What actually happened was more political than magical in nature. Baron Lethar was a vassal of Count Andro, who in turn swore fealty directly to His Grace, the Duke of Castol. While the coastal Inarian Academy was technically within the Duchy of Castol, by tradition and inheritance, the local lord of that land had always sworn allegiance to the Duke of Rhemir. But since the district would starve without the upriver traffic from the rest of Castol, a sophisticated compromise was reached between the two ducal houses in which the Lord of Inarian, who actually lived 7 miles upriver of the town, swore fealty and military allegiance to Rhemir, with the understanding that Inarian domain would be neutral in any military conflict between the two, and paid a tribute to the Duke of Castol in the name of good relations and low tariffs. Many other feudal obligations and privileges were also split up. Included in the negotiations was the right of the Duke of Castol to name 18 qualified appointees to the ancient Inarian Academy of Magic every 2 years. That year, 16 of those appointments had already been made. The Duke wisely deferred the actual selection to his court mage, of course, who had found 16 noble sons from across Ulshar who had at least a lick of talent in them to fill the quota. My scores were better than most of them, so including me in the application was not a problem. On parchment. It was politically astute as well. By admitting me under his auspices, Count Andro was able to gain favor from Baron Lethar, an established riverlord from a distinguished house who had a vote on the county council, which could elect the count's successor and affect policy on the council, and was respected and influential among the petty nobility of the region. When Master Tilo explained all this to me, I was anxious that I somehow owed Count Andro for the boon. But the court mage waved away my objections and gave me my first real lesson in feudal politics. It was all part of the complex exchange of favors, goods, services, rents, rights, and fealties that made up the feudal economy of the Five Duchies, he explained. My appointment was just another line in the ledger, like an estate's revenue or the number of fish taken from a river. To send a commoner from his baronial village to the great Inarian Academy of Magic brought personal and institutional honor to Baron Lethar, and if he someday wanted a favor in return, he might expect me to be well disposed to him. But there was no outright debt. It was a matter of honor. Baron Lethar was so proud of me, in fact, that he contributed a sizable purse toward my upkeep while at school, in addition to a little contribution from Master Tilo and Dad's own generous, though decidedly smaller, gift. I won't say it was a fortune, but it would have set me up nicely on a small farmstead had I spent it that way. My last few weeks in Tolri were bittersweet. Never had the colors seemed so vivid, the smells so potent, the village girls so accommodating. Even my mates were sad to see me go. My family was as restrained as a house full of doting sisters could be. Mama was a sobbing wreck. Dad was grimly encouraging, dispensing a lifetime of fatherly advice with every breath. Me? I was terrified. My parents threw me a huge party on the eve of my departure, inviting all of my friends and a good number of general well-wishers to the shop to celebrate. It was at this event that girls 3 and 4 made the acquaintance of my magic wand, as I had taken to calling it. The morning of my departure I was almost glad to be going. I was exhausted. I'm not saying I had been completely celibate during my 6 months or so in Bovol. There were enough maidens and widows and lusty wives eager to reduce their fees by being accommodating, but I had wisely decided against embarking on too many entangling affairs until I had a good handle on the local political situation. No need for a pitchfork wedding or starting a blood feud if I could help it. That was poor professional practice. I had managed 2 or 3 visits a month to a few friendly ladies around the Vale for quite satisfactory and unentangling encounters. But Alia made me want to stand taller in a way that those casual boards did not. I wanted to impress her with my strength, enchant her with my wit, and do pretty much anything I could to continue speaking to her. It was an unusual feeling for me, who had been a renowned lech in my previous incarnation as a war mage, and as a student. But there was something genuinely noble in her bearing, far beyond that of a simple farmer's daughter, which had captivated me. Yet her warmth and wit kept me at odds, and excited. It was very disconcerting. Her sister Ella, a taller, thinner version of Alia, threw a fit when she saw her poor, battered husband. Luckily, the charo root had taken effect by then, and he was able to reassure her. Had he been unconscious, there was no telling what she would have done. Ella had little of her younger sister's composure. Quite the opposite. Alia was calm in the face of peril, while Ella seemed to look for every excuse to get excited. I watched in amazement as the older woman managed to call on nearly every deity I'd ever heard of, and some variations that were new to me, while she simultaneously berated and babied her husband as she led him to their bed. When I was sure he was comfortable, I let Alia lead us out of the house and into the kitchen courtyard and away from her emotional sister.
"Give them a moment," she insisted. "He will need more medical attention soon, if I'm not wrong. I'll run into Hemis and summon the barber. But if you don't let Ella fuss for a while, you won't get the chance to examine him."
She sounded frustrated and tired, and I realized what course the barber in Hemis might take with the wounds. Sargal might be looking at an amputation. It was hard running a farm with one arm. "He's stable for the moment, but don't get the barber. I should be able to help, if you don't mind me using magic." Alia looked relieved, then concerned.
"Would that work?"
"I've set broken arms before," I offered, not mentioning that it hadn't gone well, "and I've tended men with combat wounds. It might take a while, but he's not bleeding profusely anymore. But I could use a good wash-up before I tend him. Tin, why don't you grab the kit from the horses and bring the blue bag, too?"
"Use the trough," she said, gesturing towards a wide wooden trough near the well.
The water seemed clean enough, and sufficient to remove at least the top layer of grime. I shrugged and stripped off my shirt.
"That was very brave, what you did on the road," she said conversationally, as she dug around in a bucket looking for soap. "I expect that from the castle men. Strong and stupid is how Kusi likes them. But you're a spellmonger. With a sword, granted, but still just a spellmonger. Why did you do it?"
I told her just enough of my recent military past to earn a few admiring glances, though I think she was more impressed by my giving up the supposedly lucrative and exciting life of an itinerant war mage to become a spellmonger. Or it could have been my shirtless chest. I was kind of hoping it was the former, but I wouldn't turn away interest in the latter. I could tell she was a no-bullshit kind of girl, so I kept the embellishments of my exploits to a minimum. But I will admit to gratuitously flexing my muscles a little, seeing as how my shirt was off and all. I wasn't as well-built as I'd been in my army days, but I was proud of what I had and didn't mind sharing. As I finished washing up, she provided me a rough homespun towel and started to help me struggle back into my clothes, when she noticed their condition. She clucked over them, stained with sweat, road dust, black hair and blood.
"Don't you know any cleaning spells?"
she asked sarcastically. "Plenty. They all take 2 or 3 days to do. Except with Erionite, I reminded myself. Then it's supposed to only take a blink and a wave. It's usually easier to wash them by hand. I pay a woman in Minden's Hall once a month to do them.
I was afraid you would say that,
she sighed. But these are unacceptable. I'll get one of Sagal's shirts for you while I get Ella to wash this one. You won't want her in the room with you while you're healing, or do you?
Brigger's bright brow, no,
I exclaimed, imagining trying to concentrate on spell work while the older sister clucked in the background. Give her a task, any task, by all means. Have her boil some water. That should keep her busy, I suggested. I'm going to need a lot of focus to put that shoulder right. I couldn't so much as light a candle with her fussing about.
As I figured, she agreed with a smile. I'll set her to it.
Soon I was kneeling next to Sargal's bed, wearing Sargal's oversized shirt, examining his wounds more circumspectly. I had dosed him with a mild anesthetic to keep him calm during the process. I was sure to inflict a lot of pain while I worked, and I didn't want this big bear of a farmer to come off that table swinging in a panic while I was in a trance. Tyndall sat on a stool just behind me and to my right. He held a wide, flat, black bowl full of water, and a few drops of Sargal's blood, of which there was an ample supply, splashed into it. It was part of a scrying spell I could use to see the details of his injuries. The spell is a variation on mage sight, with the bloody water acting as both a scrying medium to help focus the accuracy of the reading and a connection device to the patient. Once Ella was out of the room and I attained the right state of mind, I was able to use it to see inside of Sargal. And he was a mess. The gut wound was the most serious, so I attended to it first. The small intestine had been nicked, and the kidney was bruised by the force of the goblin's blow. Extending my awareness deep into his body, down to the lowest level of those blocks from which all life is built, I was able to understand the extent of the wound, and began the subtle spells to repair it. Such work is time-consuming and painstaking, requiring a tremendous amount of focus. As I was racing against sepsis, I did it the easiest, fastest, and sloppiest way possible. Imagine grabbing 2 bricks in either hand, then force them together and apply mortar, with your tongue, while you are in a driving rain. Yes, it is that difficult, and it was not my best skill by far. But the wound was not extensive, just deep. The worst of it also the least of it. Little could be done with the bruised kidney. It would have to heal on its own. But the nick in the bowel that could end his life with infection was mended slowly, but before it could leak much of its contents into his abdominal cavity. As soon as I was sure that there were no leaks in my repair, I withdrew. At least an hour had passed. I was ravenous, and my borrowed shirt was soaked through with sweat. The exertions of the last few days were beginning to remind me of the worst parts of my army days, when we would fight and march for days on end without a real rest. All I wanted to do was collapse next to my patient, but there was far more work to be done. Tyndall gave me a big draught of cold water and a few sips of wine before I started on the arm and shoulder. I doubled the dosage of pain-killing herbs for this. Fixing a gut wound is hardly even painful compared to resetting bone. I was a little better at this part, though. Bones are easier for me. Why, I don't know. But this wasn't a simple fracture either. Each individual sliver of bone had to be coaxed back into place. It takes a great deal of patience and causes a lot of pain. The spell that adheres wounded bone back into place is much harder than the relatively simple grow spell I used on his gut. Each tiny shard had to be aligned and then mortared with a rune, and each took a profound effort and no little expenditure of personal power. I was halfway through with the arm when I realized that I was about to collapse. I had expended far, far more energy in the last few days than my body could afford, and healing work requires intense focus and concentration compared to war magic or spellmongering. It wouldn't have been so hard had I been back at the academy, or even in the army, but I'd had the vigor of youth to assist then. The power of Imperial-style magic is the ability for magi to combine their efforts to avoid the perils of just this sort of expenditure. If I'd been working with someone on this, they could keep me going by feeding me power. But I was effectively on my own here. No help in sight. Tyndall was years away from the proficiency he would need to actively assist in an arcane power transfer. There was still far too much to heal in that shoulder before the threat of amputation was over. I was about to give up, fall over, and consign myself to oblivion and an amputation when I noticed a pool of power just waiting, asking, begging to be used. The Witchstone. I didn't want to do it. I knew the hazards of messing around with strange magics. I didn't have the slightest clue about its proper use, or of the dangers involved. Just possessing it made me a criminal under the bans of magic, and using it could theoretically compel the censorate to seek me out and put me to death. That was beside the fact that it was an unknown device of immense power from a non-human race, which I had no real idea how to use. My reckless behavior, to the contrary, I am a coward at heart when it comes to thaumaturgy, but I could argue that my judgment was impaired by exhaustion, distraction, and anxiety. After debating long and hard with myself, I didn't see how I had much choice. I didn't even take it out of the pouch. I was afraid to touch it with my bare hands. But it throbbed with arcane potential there in the pouch, calling for me to use it, like a crystal glass of purest water in front of a man 3 days parched. It was just too easy for me to extend my awareness and pull forth the tiniest thread of power. So I did. Suddenly I was energized, awake, aware, and bursting with vitality. This, I realized, was what all the fuss was about. The thread turned into a stream, and then I welcomed the torrent of the energy into my system, raw, untamed and unturned. My mind directed it without my consciousness, sending it where it needed to go. Every fiber in my body and soul was washed in the refreshing potency of that torrent. I took just a moment to revel in the power, and then finished setting the crushed bone in seconds, drawing the fragments together like a lodestone draws metal filings. The spell that had seemed nearly impossible to continue a moment before was suddenly trivial. While I was at it, I healed the spider web of fractures in the scapula too. It fused together under my command without the benefit of an organized spell. Just to be sure, and as an excuse to use the power, I bound the whole thing up with a particularly difficult binding spell, the kind that you usually use to fuse giant blocks of stone together. It's a permanent enchantment, the kind nobles pay large sums for, and it usually takes days or weeks of preparation and execution. Every other bone in Sargal's body could be smashed to a pulp, and his left arm and shoulder would remain pristine, I was confident. I couldn't stop there. If I was to be hunted down and hung by the lads from the censorate, I wanted to make certain it was worth it. I didn't even need to turn to the bowl for scrying. I could use simple mage sight and see the damage. I went back and did a more elegant job on the intestine, secured the sealite placed on his veins, and then probed his bloodstream for signs of infection as an afterthought. I was almost disappointed when I didn't find any. I was like a kid with a new toy, and I wanted to use it. Finally, I forced myself to let the power go. That was hard. When it withdrew back into the Eirianite, I remained energized, like I had slept for a week. I understood how the mad mage must have felt while he was raining magical death down on my squad. It was like the best parts of being drunk and doing magic and having sex and every other wonderful thing in your life, all at the same time. That level of potency was addictive, I realized, and I could see the danger in using it. More disturbing was the echo of the spell when I finished. Among the feelings produced by the after-effects was a tinge of malevolence, perhaps a vestigial vibration left over from its previous owner. I brushed it off. Compared to the great advantage of an endless font of power, a little dark murmuring in my soul was nothing. I made sure that Sargal was resting comfortably, then went outside with Tyndall, and splashed more water on my face to rinse the sheen of sweat away. I felt strange. My senses were hyper-acute. I could feel the breeze against my face like a whirlwind, and the sounds of the farmstead were amplified to the point where I could hear each individual chicken scratch the earth. Every smell was vital in my nose, from the dung on the great pile to the herbal smell of late summer wildflowers dying in the rafters of the croft. I was breathing hard just to enjoy the feel of air in my lungs. The feeling started to pass almost at once, but already I wanted to delve into the stone's power again. Coming out of the state was like putting a sack over your head and trying to go about your daily life. That was even harder under my circumstances. I was distracted by the thought and the intoxicating smell of Alia as she helped us get cleaned up. She had taken the opportunity to wash up after the unexpected battle herself, and the herbal scent of her hair was nearly enough to drive thoughts of limitless magical power clean out of my head.
"Is there much more?" she asked worriedly. "I'm done," I said,
marveling at the echo of my voice inside my own voice had.
"Sagal will be fine.
There should be a few days of weakness while the spells are working, but the bones are healed and the rent in his gut is sealed. A few days of rest and then he can go back to tossing cows around the farm as usual." She sighed gratefully.
"Thank you. What do we owe you, Master Minolan? We aren't wealthy, but we aren't destitute either."
I could tell she was a little anxious about the fee, and I couldn't blame her. That kind of spellmongering was expensive, especially if we were used to Garkescu the Great's usual.